Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In my newspaper today, there's an ad that says, "Welcome home. We make American dreams come true." That's a dream that many have, home ownership. It was that very dream that morphed into a financial crisis, which almost took the American economy under in 2008. And New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter Gretchen Morgenson, along with her co-author Joshua Rosner, detail all the players and how it happened. And we'll look to the future as well with Gretchen Morgenson. The book is Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Gretchen Morgenson is coming to Utah for the Sundance Resort Author Series. That'll be happening on Saturday. And Gretchen Morgenson, welcome to Access Utah today.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm happy to be with you this morning.
We appreciate you taking some time to be with us. Let me ask you, some of the details here, of course, are known, scary details, I should add, known by all of us. What was the goal in putting together the whole story?
You know, what we wanted to try to do was to go back in time to create sort of a timeline where we could focus on events that may have been forgotten. We go back to 1991, Tom, as sort of our starting point. And, you know, the fact is a crisis of this size and magnitude and damage just doesn't happen overnight. And, you know, I think that a lot of people are still baffled and a little bit bewildered about what really happened. So our goal was to really do a little bit of history of the, you know, kind of push for home ownership and how, as you aptly said, it morphed into something entirely different. And so we went back to 91 and looked at kind of highlights or key events and, you know, connected the dots for our readers.
Before we get into some of the details and some of the interesting parts of the book are the people, including
yes,
the chairman of Fannie Mae and chairman of Countrywide, and some of the Congress people. How close did we come to total financial meltdown, a depression?
Well, you know, I remember sitting in my chair here at the New York Times in September of 2008 and just watching really with horror at the stock market collapsing. You probably remember when the TARP bill failed to pass Congress the first time. I think the stock market went down 500, 600 points in about 2 minutes or 1 minute. It was really a shocking time. And, you know, the interesting thing, Tom, is that we are still doing sort of forensic work to understand this crisis, because I think there's been a pretty concerted effort to keep a lot of the details under wraps. I mean, some of the bailouts that took place, we really have still not understood or have been given documentation of the back and forth, who made the decisions, who made the calls. And so, as a journalist who's been covering this now for, you know, 5 years, it's really become more like archaeology than journalism. But I think it's important because if we really want to avoid, you know, going through anything like this again, we really need to understand the architecture of the problem, how it happened, and who put it all together.
This begins, you begin in your book with an excerpt from a speech from President Clinton, who was expressing the opinion of many that more Americans should live the American dream by being homeowners. That's sort of where you start.
Yeah, you know, there was this push in 95, and it's interesting to look back on it now because having experienced the nightmare of foreclosure, so many people are having trouble holding on to their homes. You know, homeownership is, I think, cast in a very different light today. But back in 95, it really was framed as a goal that would be a win-win for everyone, certainly a win for the economy in America. There's a tremendous amount of economic activity surrounding home ownership, whether it's home construction, The insurance industry, mortgage lending, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of GDP that comes out of the sort of housing industrial complex, as it were. So the economy certainly was going to benefit from a push for home ownership. And it was framed also as a way for people to create wealth. And in fact, for many, many generations, home ownership has been the best way for people to save money, pay off their mortgage, and then, you know, hand the property over to their children or grandchildren. But what happened, Tom, in this particular episode was that we removed that forced savings aspect of home ownership. We started to allow people to tap into the equity value in their homes and use them as an ATM. And that sort of circumvented the entire forced savings aspect of home ownership, which perverted the goals of wealth creation.
And we all know that the rules were considerably relaxed. Did that start with Fannie Mae?
Yes, actually, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were, because they're so large in the mortgage industry, they set the tone for the choices that are made, decisions made on such things as who will get a loan, how loans are made, the automation process in underwriting loans. That is really where Fannie and Freddie led the way, and they speeded up the process. It was all about, you know, sort of easing the housing finance process. And so that was where they started. And then, of course, much later, Wall Street really took that lead and ran with it and created mortgage products that were just completely toxic, poisonous, and inappropriate for most borrowers. You know, these were the liar loans. These were the loans that in which you only paid a portion of the interest, that where the principal would grow rather than be reduced over time. And these were all sort of called affordability products to make housing more affordable, but in actuality they were quite poisonous, and they really roped a lot of people into loans they didn't understand and then could not repay.
But Countrywide had a fast and easy loan, and there was a license plate, vanity license plate. The company executive said Fundum, I guess.
Yes. Fundum, as in fund anyone. Anyone with a pulse would get a mortgage from Countrywide. And part of the problem, of course, as you know, Tom, is that Countrywide would simply sell the loans either to investors or to Fannie Mae. So it had no potential problem with those loans. They were not going to come back to haunt Countrywide. They would, in fact, harm the people who had purchased the loans, whether they were investors who, you know, bought securities in a pension fund or a mutual fund, or Fannie Mae, for that matter. Countrywide was Fannie Mae's largest single supplier of loans over the years. So a lot of the losses that taxpayers are shouldering now in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac came from our friends at Countrywide. Mm.
And there were complaints by some that, I can't remember the company, it was one of the other companies, Novastar perhaps?
Yes.
That had offices in massage parlors, and some offices didn't even exist if you tried to contact them. It was just a big bubble, I guess, waiting to be burst.
Well, you know, it was something that I think was one of those public-private partnerships that, unfortunately, there was no sort of balancing act going on. It was everybody was all in for the idea of homeownership, and yet the regulators who were charged with, you know, overseeing the industry and trying to rein in what would be anybody would call reckless practices were really, you know, a part of the partnership. And that was one of the key failures and one of the key elements that led to where we wound up, and that is a complete regulatory failure, complete failure to rein in the practices that really caused so much damage and have hurt so many people. So it was a concerted effort, and of course anyone who criticized the push, anyone who, you know, would say, well, maybe everyone should not own a home. Maybe there are people who are better off renting, would just be steamrolled by, you know, the companies. Fannie and Freddie were huge lobbying machines that were really all about protecting their enormous government subsidy.
And it is a powerful ideal, isn't it? Home ownership.
Yes.
And it was used as a weapon. Tell me about James Johnson. He perfected the art of lobbying, didn't he?
He did. Now, he was the chief executive of Fannie Mae from 1991 to 99. And so he left the scene well before the collapse. But what he really did was laid the groundwork for the large increase in the company's balance sheet that took on bigger portfolios by the day. He also was really the architect and the master of the lobbying, the aggressive brass-knuckles lobbying that the company practiced. It was all about, again, protecting the subsidy. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had government ties because Fannie Mae had originally been a government agency, but it also had stockholders as of the 1960s, and so it became one of these hybrid companies that did have a call on the government, but at the same time was a profit-oriented company that had shareholders to satisfy. So we had it's sort of the hybrid company, and it turns out to have been a disastrous concept because, of course, the taxpayers wound up paying the bill when the losses came in, but over the years before the losses, many of the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac executives earned just hundreds of millions of dollars, deployed lobbying machines, rewarded their friends in Congress with campaign contributions, and it was just a classic case of running over any criticism and making sure that their subsidy was protected.
Do you agree with the idea of a corporation like this, a quasi-governmental corporation? Should it have just been completely privatized or be a government organization?
Yes, I think one or the other, Tom, because the ultimate incentive really is to take risk, right, to make your bonus, to grow the company, and particularly if you know that you will be bailed out by the taxpayer, then you have absolutely no risk for you are not vulnerable at all if you do decide to take gambles that don't pay off. So it's kind of the worst of both worlds. It's the idea that the government should stand behind the company, and that really creates the push to take risks that may not pan out because, the executives will not pay the freight for it. It's going to be the taxpayers' bill.
We're talking with Gretchen Morgenson on this part of Access Utah. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times business reporter, writes a column for them. Her new book with Joshua Rosner is Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon, detailing the lead-up to the 2008 financial crisis. You're welcome to join this conversation if you would like at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or an email will come through to us if you email upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. The number, once again, is 1-800-826-1495. Gretchen Morgenson will be coming to Utah on Saturday as part of the Sundance Resort Author Series. Doors open at 11:30. Brunch begins at noon, author presentation 1 o'clock, followed by a question and answer and a book signing. And that's at Sundance Resort, of course. I want to follow up with where you spread the blame widely, including Congress, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the mortgage companies themselves. Part of this, though, wasn't it a rising economy? People's incomes were rising. They had more income. and people wanted to get into homes, right? So where do you place the blame on people who actually took these bad loans?
Well, you know, there was a lot of speculation going on. There's no doubt about that, Tom. And, of course, you couldn't go to a cocktail party or a backyard barbecue without hearing about someone's huge, enormous gains in their real estate. There was an awful lot of second home buying going on that was pushing this bubble also. But my answer to the question of who's more to blame, is it the borrowers or is it the institutions that made the loans, I think is best answered by a little anecdote about what the lenders were supposed to be doing at the time when they were making these loans. I spoke with a man back in, long ago, in 2007, who had set up a company for lenders to so that he could document the income of borrowers who were signing these so-called liar loans. As you recall, the loans were being made where you just verified your income. You didn't have to provide a W-2. You didn't have to provide any kind of a tax return. And, you know, companies were so eager to make these kinds of loans that borrowers were just basically attesting to their own income and financial position. Well, this gentleman that I interviewed had set up a company to, check with the IRS about the claims that borrowers were making on their loans. And every time you get a mortgage, you sign a document which is called 4506T. It's an IRS document, and it allows the IRS, you are signing a document allowing the IRS to disclose your income. And so this man, this entrepreneur, obviously felt this was going to be a big business. Loans were being made, you know, buckets and buckets of them, and people needed to verify income. Well, he set up his business, and his phone never rang because the banks didn't care. They didn't want to check the income. So every time a borrower would fill out this form, it would go into the circular file, and no one would ever contact the IRS to verify the income. So when I heard about that, I thought to myself, this really does, I think, explain vividly how little the banks cared about the loans that they were making. And the reason was that they were selling them to others and that they would not be holding the bag if there were problems. So that whole idea of, you know, going to the IRS to prove your income, nobody did it. The bankers didn't care. And so I think that lays much of the blame at their feet.
Mm. What about the regulators? I think you point fingers definitely at the regulators, who I believe you say were pretty much, I don't know if it's too harsh a word to say, co-opted?
I think that's an accurate word. Having followed and reported a lot on the Federal Reserve Board, the Office of Thrift Supervision, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, these were all the big bank regulators. It really has become clear to me that the regulatory framework is, the mindset is very similar to the mindset of the institutions that they are supposed to be policing. And I don't know if it's because they are in constant contact with these people and they sort of get into their orbit and start feeling, thinking like they do, or whether it's because of their revolving door where many people leave government to go into the finance industry. There are a lot of possible reasons why, but I think it's absolutely clear that the regulatory mindset, certainly back in the mania, the mortgage mania, was to continue to let these products be developed, that they were innovations that should not be thwarted, and that it was not going to harm the financial system. Obviously, that was incorrect, and so now we're trying to recover from that. But it was an abject failure, I think. The FDIC was the only institution that really seemed to be alert to the problems, and it battled hard against the others, against its peers in the regulatory world, to try to rein in some of these practices, but it was really pretty much standing alone.
There are some who argue that government involvement, government regulation, is the problem. One example is reading in a review of your book in Forbes magazine, your former magazine, John Tamney, columnist. He praises elements of your book, but he asserts an example on the other side that if government would get out of it, sometimes government involvement props up corporations, mortgage lenders, which would fail in a totally private scenario, and some of these big corporations would split off if government were not involved.
Well, I think that is the message that we take away from the crisis, and that is that the government really dispensed immense amounts of money and stepped in to save troubled companies like never before. And so we do have to, I think, take away from the experience the fact that the government has made a choice that it is going to do that, that it did do that, and that it's going to do that in the future. And unfortunately, the Dodd-Frank legislation that was passed to try to, make sure that such an episode did not happen again has really not addressed the issue of what we call too big to fail institutions. That is, institutions that are very politically connected and or connected in the financial world. So we really are still at the mercy of large institutions. In fact, many of the banks have gotten bigger since the crisis, and that problem and that potential threat has not been resolved at all by the regulation.
But you do believe that tougher regulation could head off some of these problems?
Well, I would say that an appetite to regulate would have set off these problems. I do not believe that we needed additional rules necessarily or new rules. The fact was there was no one enforcing the rules that were on the books. So you actually had some rules about, non-traditional mortgage products that were completely ignored. And you also had regulators completely ignoring the piling up of risks held by banks in some of these, derivatives products, very, very complex securities that I think a lot of regulators simply did not understand. And so I was never a believer that we were under-regulated. It was just that we did not have regulators who had an appetite to do their jobs.
And in fact, some would say that it doesn't matter what regulations you have, that companies will always find a way around them. One example that people on that side bring up is that the previous legislation was some 30 pages, right? Dodd-Frank is over 2,000 pages. Won't we just have the corporations getting around Dodd-Frank?
Well, you certainly could make that argument, and they're trying to do so even now, because, as you know, the regulators are the ones who are charged with writing the actual nuts and bolts of the law, how things are going to work, whether it's in the commodities arena, the securities arena, banking, whatever. And so they're now under immense lobbying pressure from institutions who have an interest in the outcome. And so once again, they're trying to, in many cases, water down what rules were created.
We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we'll ask Gretchen Borgeson to tell us about some other interesting people involved. There is a lot of blame to go around in Congress, and Gretchen Borgeson in her book quotes Barney Frank, for example, and Newt Gingrich, who were quite sanguine about the situation pretty soon before the scandal happened. Also, Angelo Mozzillo, like her to tell me about him, the CEO at one time of Countrywide. And we'll ask, could this happen again? All these questions to come. We're talking with Gretchen Borgeson, Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter for the New York Times, along with Joshua Rosner. She's written a new book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. And Gretchen Borgeson is coming to Utah as part of the Sundance Resort Author Series. That is on Saturday. Coming up, we have a Steve Eaton commentary, and we'll be back after that.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
Aren't you glad you aren't Mitt Romney? I may be the only person in the world who listens to the talking heads analyze and talk about each primary like they were important sporting events that really mattered. I may be the only one left in Utah who probably isn't a Romney supporter. I say probably because I feel sorry for him. No matter how good he does, no matter how many delegates he wins, the commentators see it as clear evidence that he's about to fail. Even sports guys know that if one team has a 100-point lead, that team's doing pretty good. And how would you feel if everywhere you went, someone was saying you didn't measure up to the high standards that Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich are setting? Now that would hurt. In addition to feeling bad for Mitt, sometimes I feel like voting for Romney just because I'm worried about what he'll do if he's not elected. He's been being nice to all of us and smiling all the time for years now. That's got to be hard. Do you have any idea how mad he's going to be if he doesn't get to be president? Oh, I don't want to be around for that. He'll make Bob Dole look downright cheerful. Okay, this is a part where I'm supposed to pretend like Ron Paul doesn't exist. I like Ron Paul. If all the Republican performers were my neighbors, I'm guessing Ron Paul would be the only one who'd be willing to come over and eat cookie dough pizza and watch The Office with me. I bet I'd laugh harder at that episode with him than any before it. Okay, so here's a day in my life if I was treated like Mitt Romney, Wolf Blitzer. So Anderson, what do you make of the fact that Steve seems insistent that he can continue to go to work despite recent polls that show that 40% of all his coworkers think he's mentally imbalanced and 65% thinks he eats too much cookie dough? Anderson Cooper, well, so far he's managed to get the work done, but let's face it, he's just plain no good at this. Wolf Blitzer, some 32% of people have said they'd prefer to work with anyone else, even Rick Santorum. A recent poll said that 55% of people trust Newt Gingrich over Eaton to clean out the microwave in the break room. Now that's a serious issue Eaton's going to have to deal with if he's going to keep his job. Anderson Cooper, well, the truth is a lot of people feel that Eaton is just plain too perfect, too good looking. They can't connect to him. Okay, you were with me right up to that point, weren't you? Yeah, I'll have you know that I used to have good hair. It's true, it was never all organized like Mitt Romney's hair, but I had good hair. You think Romney has it bad? Poor Obama. I know, people in Utah are so sore at him that they talk about him like he's the devil himself. Or worse, a Democrat. He told us he could do better than the dope in the White House and he could change everything. Now we blame him instead of the guy who used to be there. I guess that's a change. Well, we've learned our lesson, and this time we're going to vote for a Republican who promises us he'll fix everything and give us an America we can believe in. For me, I wouldn't promise I'd fix everything. I'd just say stuff like, vote for me, and I'll let you ride in that big airplane with a bump on it. Or, vote for me, and I'll turn things over to the original cast in the West Wing. They were way good at running the country. And the Republicans are so busy criticizing each other and Obama, you wonder if they're really thinking through what they say. I saw a story recently where Newt Gingrich said that Romney was the weakest frontrunner since 1920, so that we should vote for someone like Newt because he'd be more electable than Mitt. Wouldn't you think Gingrich would have a campaign aide somewhere who would tell him how silly that sounds? I wouldn't bring that up because, well, you see, the truth is you haven't been able to beat him, and that makes you the guy who can't beat the weakest front runner in nearly a century. Oh, right, my bad. I'm guessing Newt Gingrich doesn't have any PR people, because if he did, they would tell people to stop chanting, Newt, 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 at campaign rallies, because it makes his events look like very funny Monty Python sketches. The election seems to be about just waiting to see if a candidate will say something, anything that's politically incorrect. If I were forced to go on stage and make intense, intelligent arguments in 60-second increments, I would make Rick Perry look like a genius. And that's why I would make a great... What am I running for again? How long would you last if someone followed you around and recorded everything you said? How long would it take you before you said that you were in favor of something before you opposed it? If a room full of sixth graders were pressuring you, could you spell potato? When I was in fourth grade, I raised my hand before a test to ask the teacher if I was male or female. I knew I was a guy, I just didn't know the technical scientific term for my gender. My friends scorned and ridiculed me for years over that one blunder, but eventually they forgot about it. However, if I had been a fourth grader running for president, that would end my political career right there and then. And that's just not right. Yeah, I'm glad I'm not Mitt Romney. And I'll bet you $10,000 you are too. This is Steve Eaton.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the Cache Valley Center for the Arts, presenting the touring production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Tony Award-winning Cats, April 3rd and 4th at 7:30 p.m. Ticket information is at centerforthearts.us.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the financial crisis of 2008. Gretchen Morgenson and her co-author Joshua Rosner have detailed the causes of that crisis. All of the players, the book is Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Gretchen Morgenson is a Pulitzer Prize winner. She's a business reporter for the New York Times, has a column there. And she's coming to Utah as part of the Sundance Resort author series. That's on Saturday. Gretchen Morgenson, I noticed reading your biography, you have been a stockbroker. You were Dean Witter in the 1980s. And I believe at one time wrote for Vogue magazine.
Yes, it's my checkered career, Tom. What can I say? I actually was a stockbroker for 3 years in New York. It was what I would consider kind of a great education process for me. It was what I would call like my working man's MBA. I did not have the money to go back to get an MBA, and so I dove into the wild and woolly world of Wall Street and really got an understanding of the way that world works and you know, how important capital formation is for companies and for investors. And so it gave me a terrific grounding in the area that I then, you know, began pursuing as a reporter. My first job in New York was as a slave at Vogue magazine, and my only regret is that I did not write Devil Wears Prada, because it certainly was my experience, and I should have been the author on that book since I lived it.
So you probably read that book and watched the movie with great interest.
Yes.
We do have a caller. Let's bring in David in Ogden. David, welcome to the program.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead with your question.
I'd just like your guest to speak to two different laws. One was the Glass-Steagall Act that was eliminated in 1999, I believe, under the Clinton administration, and also the Commodities Futures Modernization Act that was pushed through by Phil Graham back in about 2000. What did those two, how did those, the passage of the one law and the elimination of the other, how did that play into this whole housing crisis?
Well, certainly the elimination of the last vestiges of Glass-Steagall was a crucial moment in the timeline towards the crisis. So, you know, it had been, Glass-Steagall was put in place during the Depression, the Great Depression, and it had lasted really 70 years and had been really a pretty sturdy and good law and very, very simple, basically separated commercial banks, i.e. the banks that a depositor puts money in and that makes commercial loans, from investment banks, where you have individuals making bets for the investment firm using its own money. They separated those two entities, and that was a very shrewd and good idea. Well, over the years, it became we forgot about the consequences of the Depression and what had brought it on. And so in our infinite wisdom and with a lot of lobbying from financial services companies, Congress was persuaded that we could do away with Glass-Steagall. And really, I think probably the person most responsible for that change was Robert Rubin, who then, as you know, received a huge job at Citigroup, which was the company that wanted Glass-Steagall to go by the boards more than any other. So it was a moment that was important in the lead up to the crisis, and it absolutely contributed to the fact that banks could take major and risky bets using depositors' money, which means that the government bailout would occur. Now, as far as the Commodities Futures Trading Act or the Commodities Modernization Trading Act, that was something that did not have a direct relationship to mortgage securities, which were the main sort of, cause of the crisis. But it was, again, an example of this rush to deregulate an entire swath of the financial world, and that was commodities. So you had, again, this idea, as it was with Glass-Steagall, that we didn't need regulation for these enterprises and for this industry. And unfortunately, we did, and that is where you saw the increase in, for instance, credit default swaps, these derivatives. Were in many cases freed up to trade because of that Modernization Act. So that was a big part of certainly the AIG bailout and some of the other messes that we had to live through.
David, thank you. Appreciate the question. And David called 1-800-826-1495. And you can as well. We'd love to have your question or comment for Gretchen Morgenson, author of Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. We're talking about the financial collapse of 2008, the causes for that, looking to the future as well. Gretchen Morgenson, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. The number again is 1-800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or you can go to upraccess@gmail.com. Get an email through to us, upraccess@gmail.com. I saw in Bill Moyers, you said something very scary. He asked you, could this happen again? You said not only could it will.
Well, again, I think this goes back, Tom, to this idea that we didn't fix the problems. We didn't fix the major problems. You know, even though Dodd-Frank runs to 2,000 pages, again, as I mentioned earlier, it did nothing about too-big-to-fail institutions. It did nothing to require banks to cut themselves down to a more manageable size. It was also silent on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two companies that, as you know, the taxpayer has given them $183 billion at last count to cover mortgage losses. So those are two elements right there that I think tell you why such an incident could easily happen again. We did not correct the behavior. We did not rule out the idea that taxpayers would once again have to bail out these institutions. And in fact, they are getting larger. It's not as though they're shrinking in size as a result of the crisis. So I think for those reasons alone, we do have a lot of work to do if we want to avoid another crisis like this occurring again.
Are all of the bailouts of the same worthiness? There's been a lot of talk about the GM bailout and how that was a good thing. I don't know if you support that. The financial bailouts, some people supported and some others they didn't. Generally, do you feel like the government should be bailing out these corporations?
Well, I think it's very difficult to make that argument that they should be bailing them out, in every case, because, once again, that's really not the way capitalism is supposed to work. It's supposed to be a situation where you take a risk and you suffer the consequences of that risk. If it's not a well-thought-through risk, if it's a speculation that doesn't work out, you should not really be allowed to call on the taxpayer to make up your losses. I think that's a very disturbing development if that's going to be the way the world works going forward. So, just from that standpoint, it's, I think, pretty evident that the quasi-government setup for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, where they enjoyed the subsidies and the ties, the lucrative ties to the government, and yet took the, you know, immense amounts of money out of the companies while they were doing well, only to saddle taxpayers with losses when they went bad. I think that's a pretty good template for why we shouldn't pursue these things going forward. I also think that it's, you know, you hear a lot about whether these bailouts were paid back, i.e., you know, the Treasury Department is always coming out and saying, well, you know, all the banks have repaid their TARP, or we've made $25 billion on our mortgage buying program. And, you know, to me, those are very premature calculations. There is absolutely no way that we can make any kind of a conclusion about making a profit on bailouts when you have $183 billion into Fannie and Freddie. You still are owed, the government is still owed money on the AIG bailout, which was extremely questionable the way it was handled. And so I think that, you know, these attempts to make taxpayers feel better about the bailouts by claiming that they are profitable is really, I think, very dubious.
We have another caller. We welcome in now John in Moab. John, welcome to the program. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, hi. This is something that's been bothering me ever since this banking crisis started, and they started talking about bailing out the banks. And it's something I don't really understand. If the crisis was caused by failed mortgages that were then, you know, bundled and sold off to the whatever suckers, why didn't we bail out the mortgages? You know, in other words, bail out the actual mortgage holders. And let me just bear with me for a second. On one side of the fence, we have the banks with their perhaps 1,000 years of cumulative experience, the men with the PhDs, the lawyers, the contract writers, and all that. And on the other side of the fence, we have the loan taker who's maybe got a high school education, maybe some college, certainly no banking experience, certainly no experience in finance, being told, hey, trust us, this is a good loan, rates will never go up, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we all know what happened after that. So why didn't we bail out those people who were actually harmed, and would that have been sufficient?
Well, it's a really, really key question, I think, that you asked, John, and that is we have seen just an consistent theme ever since the crisis began, and that was that Wall Street gets the bailouts, the banks receive the bailouts, but Main Street doesn't get any help at all. And it's really been a very fascinating sequence of events, if troubling, certainly, for me, because the idea of shared sacrifice is nowhere to be found in this situation. You had the Treasury Secretary running to Congress with a three-page document asking for $750 billion to bail out the financial system. And, you know, and you had very little help provided to any borrower at all. These programs that the Treasury put in place were woeful. They were not well thought through at all. So I think you've really touched on a critical point, I think, that has led to a tremendous lack of trust, a tremendous loss of trust in our, you know, government and institutions, and that is that there sort of feels like there's two sets of rules. There's one set for the big and politically powerful institutions, and then there's the rules for the rest of us. And I think that's the deeply unfortunate, you know, conclusion to draw from the crisis.
Thank you, John.
I have a follow-up.
Go ahead.
Question.
Yes.
And that is, does that imply that we haven't actually fixed the problem? And the reason we're still in a crisis mode now is because we haven't fixed the mortgage problem. We've just helped our rich banker friends.
I think that's a good way to characterize it. We certainly have not fixed the problems, and we've talked a little bit about that in this hour with Tom. And you know, it's clear to me that the government's response to this has not been sufficient. There is absolutely no doubt that our mortgage industry is not fixed. I mean, the only mortgages in town nowadays are Fannie and Freddie backed mortgages. So bankers are reluctant to lend. If you try to get a refinance on a home that you are in, that you have a lot of equity, I hear from many people they have difficulties. So yeah, the bankers have reaped a lot in this episode, but they really haven't shared the sacrifice.
Thank you, John. Appreciate those good questions.
Great show. Thank you.
Let's go to another caller. Also in southern Utah area, we bring in Detina in Springdale. Did I say your name right, Detina?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I love your show, and I love the political comments you had earlier on the essay. My question is, so how do we as consumers protect ourselves and from this situation that's going to repeat itself and because we all feel pretty powerless at this point, and we don't have trust in our political systems having justice for us. So that's my question.
Well, I think what your takeaway is probably accurate, that you know, you can't rely on others to help. You can't rely on regulators to do the right thing and stop these kinds of practices in their tracks. And so what that means is you have to be an incredibly educated consumer, right, of financial products. And it's becoming more and more difficult because they become more and more complex as years go by. So I guess my kind of nuts and bolts recommendation would be to, you know, never believe what you hear. Always check the fine print. Always read through every document and try to pay down debt, because it's really the indebtedness of the consumer and the borrower that got everyone into so much trouble this time around. So if you are not, you know, carrying a big load of debt, then you'll be way better off if we do have another crisis down the road.
Thanks, Detina. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
And you can call. We have another about 6 minutes left with Gretchen Morgenson, author of Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. We appreciate your spending the hour with us. She's coming to Utah as a part of the Sundance Resort Author Series, and that's on Saturday. The number to call, we'd love to have your question or comment in our 6 minutes remaining, 1-800-826-1495, toll free, anywhere you're listening, 1-800-826-1495, or an email through to us at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com, or 1-800-826-1495. Our callers hit upon something. They're driving at something I think that worries a lot of us, and that's the growing inequities, you know, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, and this whole crisis highlighted that and I think probably exacerbated it.
I think so too, Tom. And, you know, it's also this question of accountability has been just amazingly potent, I think, and has been on people's minds. And that is that there was a tremendous series of mistakes, flaws in the system, whatever, and yet no one has really been held accountable for it. The regulators who failed in their jobs, they rise to even greater levels of power. You have people really that were at the heart of the crisis in jail. So there's a sense that you can kind of get away with murder if, you know, you are a powerful, work at a powerful institution, if you make it complicated enough so that people don't understand it. And, you know, that's really what another one of the sad lessons has been of the crisis.
What do you think appropriate remedies, solutions would be?
Well, I think for starters, you know, you could have the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, go after, you know, executive compensation at some of these companies. I mean, these were bonus packages that were based on, you know, making mortgages that people couldn't repay. And so they had the good years, and then, of course, the losses came later. And, you know, why not go after some of the executive compensation that these executives took while the going was good? You know, that alone would be, I think, one way to make people sit up and take notice.
And I believe we may have a call coming in. We'll want to fit this in if it is a call. I wanted to ask you about these allegations that have just come out from I think it's a mid-level executive at Goldman Sachs. He's saying there's a toxic corporate culture there, and the culture has changed over time that he's been with the company.
Yes, he was a guy who's been there for a dozen years, I guess, and I don't know him. And, you know, his resignation letter was published in the New York Times on our op-ed page, but it really literally came in, I think, over the transom. But it's a really kind of a heartfelt letter that has struck a real chord with so many people, you know, responding to it. It seems he believes that things have gone off the rails at the firm, and of course he's just one person, and so it's hard to know. They have 30,000 employees or something like that. But I think that it was it had a lot of resonance out there, because I think people take a look at some of the products that Wall Street sells and say, well, these kind of are only designed to make fees for the firms and not to help their clients. So let's look at this more closely.
We just have a couple of minutes. We'll try to fit in a call from William in Wellsville. Welcome to the program, William.
Hello.
Go ahead with your question.
I just have a comment. I believe that the system is completely broken, and that as long as we have lobbyists in the Capital, especially the lobbyists for the banks and for the Wall Street firms, that we're going, and again, when we have the American people who are in debt up to their necks, I think it's a prescription for an absolute meltdown. And I hear you talking together in very polite terms, and I'm overwhelmed by anger.
Thanks, William. And that is something that does come out in the book. There's a ton of anger, and I think a lot of people are feeling that, aren't they?
I think so, and I don't blame them. I mean, you know, it's been a really bad economic time for many people. People have lost their jobs. People have lost their homes. You know, and yet you see, you know, these powerful lobbyists exerting their voice in Washington, and, you know, the Main Street person just believes they'd don't have a voice. They don't have a mechanism to get their lawmakers to listen to them. And I think that's created a deep sense of unfairness that I think is very kind of damaging to the country's moral fiber.
And perhaps to get any change, people will have to get angry and write their congressman.
Well, you wonder if that would even, you know, get a response other than a canned letter. You know, the dysfunction seems pretty high in Washington, and the imbalance seems pretty tremendous, you know, with the powerful institutions having a lot of traction and the individual having very little.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Gretchen Morgenson, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times, author with Joshua Rosner of Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's a good read. Recommend the book. And she'll be coming to the Sundance Resort author series on Saturday. Gretchen Morgenson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. This is Utah Public Radio. KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.